Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. That's the sound of a bell in the French countryside. And it's believed that this bell has magical powers. We'll hear that story later from the artist Samson Young, who is one of three artists we'll be hearing from today, including Susan Cianciolo and Don Casper. These are Don Casper's bells. I met Don Casper 9 years ago while I was living inside an installation. A musical project I was in had created a temporary village at Human Resources Los Angeles, a gallery that Casper was, at that time, co-running. We were sleeping and performing music inside the gallery daily. It was exhausting and a pretty hazy time, so I don't remember much about it, honestly. But I do remember Casper's radiating energy, which somehow encouraged us all to keep going. I think you'll hear it in the way she talks. A few months later, I saw her perform in an apartment in Lower Manhattan. For half an hour, a small group of us watched as she fumbled with a massive, unwieldy sheet of paper, attempting to pin it to the wall, I think, while she delivered an ecstatic stream of consciousness lecture. It was pretty enthralling to watch. Sound has been essential to Casper's work since the beginning. Even the crinkling of that paper and the pitch of her voice during the lecture. And her recent work has become more and more musical. Even the physical materials of her installations have become like those of a concert, with guitars and cables and old recording devices which contain sonic documents from her life and recordings of previous performances, like the one you're hearing now. The last few years, she's also begun creating sound sculptures like Cluster, which is a collection of symbols activated by motors and triggered by motion sensors as viewers wander throughout the space. As often happens with music, Casper collaborates a lot, both with visual artists like the painter Lucy Dodd and musicians like the harpist Zena Parkins. Last year, she had a large exhibition at Porticus, a contemporary art institution in Frankfurt, Germany, where she'd performed many times with many different artists and musicians. For one of these performances, she created a musical accompaniment to the work of Berlin-based painter James Krohn, who installed his paintings in her exhibition. A few months after this show, Casper came over to my home in New York, which was the first time we'd seen each other in 6 years. In that time, she'd moved from Los Angeles to Manhattan to the quiet town of Kingston in upstate New York, which she considers to be paradise. What follows is an interview I conducted with Casper, set to the soundtrack of her performance at Porticus.
So I see James Krohn's paintings as visual music. So he created some chairs and then made paintings to go with the chairs. They kind of went together, so two chairs and two paintings. And so I then invited him to install those in the space, and then I would move them around the space and kind of trace their movement. And to activate the opening, I created a score inspired by the images. And then the viewer could sit in the chairs and listen to wireless headphones of the live score and look at the paintings. So I tend to, wherever I go, wherever I perform, I make a lot of recordings. So, for example, I was in the Venice Biennale and I installed like an artist studio. So I went there every day, all day. And so I constantly made things, constantly working, making scores, making sounds. And then people come and they make sounds with me. And so then that becomes like layered. And what will happen is I'll use sounds from live performances and fold them into new performances. So a lot of birds make a lot of bird recordings from all over the world. So I tend to use like synth, like analog synth sounds as like a kind of skeletal backing for layering. I also do like, I'm not a piano player, but I improvise on the piano or play like the flute. Like a lot of the time I'll use that time, let's say in rehearsal or in performance, to practice even. Like I'll just practice the drums. Like I kind of keep a system to it. I'm still navigating it though, because it's not as though I'm in any way a trained musician, but I've just been obsessed and played music since I was really little. Using Hitchcock as an example, like you're watching a Hitchcock film and you don't actually see him stabbing her in the shower. There's a high-pitched tone and some shadows, and it's confusing. So it puts you in that fear. The feeling, the visceral sensation of the fear. You don't actually hear that sound. I mean, God forbid, you know, when someone's getting stabbed, you don't actually hear that. Like that's intentionally placed there, you know, and then the absence of the imagery. So you are immediately in your mind. Oh my gosh. There's much more left to our own imagination that I think is much more effective. Sound really has the ability to kind of offer this lessons more, because we're so used to sound. We're so used to filtering out most, I think probably 90% of our daily sounds. Like if we take it all on, I think our heads would explode or something. Actually hung about I should have counted all of them, but maybe like 40 45 bells from the ceiling so that people could kind of interact with them in their own way. The footsteps, it's a very nostalgic sound. And it offers also a level of anxiety at the pace. But if used in conjunction with another sound, for example, a tone, or a synth, like a blisteringly loud synth sound, it gets lost, but then you have this sort of like how you would approach a painting with the foreground, middle ground, and background. You can conduct that using sound within a space. So performatively speaking, you can utilize sound to structure an environment. You can activate a certain awareness in a human brain by utilizing sort of familiar sounds. I think the absence of sound can be used in this way too. So having a blisteringly loud synth sound and then all of a sudden it stops and you hear footprints. It just offers a consciousness to the brain where it could, in theory, bring you back into your body or remind you of something either traumatic or, again, nostalgic. So with the James recording of Porticus, it was these recordings of the women in Milan and then shoes from a residency, a friend at a residency in Portland, at Pica, at Caldera, and in a way a collaboration, but I don't know, somehow I'll reuse the same sounds. So when I was younger in grad school, I worked with Jason Rhodes, and he would often reuse materials in his installations, like objects, kind of in a way recycling, repurposing. Like having that repetition, having that threading, like to show again the passage of time. I mean, that's for me as an artist, why I'm interested in performance, like bottom line.
Now let's step into the unconscious mind of another artist.
There was this type of spa where you took a bath, and there was a giant circular glass type of container above, but it was so large that the cover slid and it fell behind the wall, but it didn't crash. And then people that worked there came to get me because I had fallen asleep.
That's the voice of the artist Susan Cianciolo. She's retelling a dream she just had. I interviewed Cianciolo for the print magazine last year, and it was one of the most intimate conversations I've ever had on tape. So it felt right to have her on this first episode. Cianciolo has been making all kinds of work for many years. Clothing, sculpture, cookbooks, video. And she does it all very intuitively. She's actually just now having her first painting show called Spirit Guides up at Bridget Donahue Gallery in New York. After years of showing her fashion and installations and these little cardboard boxes she calls kits. I was at her home in Brooklyn where all her paintings filled up her living room, which is also a kind of studio for her. And we went up on the roof for a few minutes and started talking about dreams. So when this podcast started, I asked her if she would wake up and immediately record her most memorable dream from the night before, capturing the sound of her raspy, just waking up voice.
There were people staying in my place, and before I left, I was trying on pink dress and try to style for my hair to think about wearing for an opening. And then there was someone sitting on my bed. And then I kept saying I was going to go out. I wasn't going to go out. Then I went to this place to eat. And I remember it was $200 just for one meal.
She sent that to me. And she also sent a riddle by her 13-year-old daughter, Lilac, who often collaborates with her. She told me that the two of them like games that only use the voice to entertain.
There once was this man who lived in a roundhouse. When he got home, he was murdered. A detective came and asked everybody who worked for him. He asked the chauffeur. He said he was parking the car. He asked the butler. The butler said he was hanging off the man's coat. He asked the maid. She said she was sleeping in the corners. He asked the cook. The cook said she was making dinner. He asked the gardener. The gardener said she was weeding the garden. Who did it?
I don't know. I give up.
The maid. There were no corners in a roundhouse.
Tell the joke about the artist now.
Okay. Why did nobody want to be next to the artist?
Because they were sketchy.
No, because she was sketchy.
That's a...
Including that's a, you.
That's a, yes.
You're sketchy.
I agree.
Later, Cianciolo will read a little from a book that she reads to herself every single night. For me, these recordings function as a window into her life. And this is one of the goals of this show. The title of it, Subject, Object, Verb, is another way of saying artist, art, and life. Just like you can't have a complete sentence without the subject, the object, and the verb, you can't have a complete artist without the person, the work, and the process by which it's made. Not just the sculpting or the painting process, but the whole life that's required to create the work. Anytime you read a biography, you're taking in all three of these things at once. How did the person live, what were they like, and what did they make? And then all three of these things become one thing. If you're friends with any artists, you know this, you experience this. The work is the person, is the life. Think of it like a triangle in which all three elements are connected. You can't separate them. Now, you may hate this idea. You may far prefer to keep art and artists separate. You may prefer those artists who become hermits in the mountains, or the ones who refuse interviews, or who release their work anonymously. But, of course, we all know that these choices become essential to the work itself. They change the work. Even the choice to scrub all personality away from an object, even this is a choice that reflects on the artist, and one we'll try to look at. So this show will be attempting to unpack this kind of trinity every week in different ways, by offering you artists of all different varieties and different segments that seek to understand the connection between the subject, the object, and the verb. So, if Cianciolo's recording was a window into her life, now let's turn to some specific objects, some sound works, in a kind of mixtape made by the artist Samson Young. Samson Young is based in Hong Kong, and he studied classical composition and contemporary art, and the way he uses sound kind of slides around between both. He'll write for orchestra and for electronics, but he'll also reappropriate pop music and Cantonese nursery rhymes and transform these into installations. He makes video works from field recordings, like this one.
You want it, dollar express.
This is a field recording of a tobacco auction in North Carolina. And the tobacco auctioneer you're hearing in the recording, his name is Chuck Jordan, and he is one of the last tobacco auctioneers left. Tobacco auctioneering is a dying craft. And when they, it's really quite amazing what they do when they auction off tobacco. You get these big stacks of tobacco leaves that potential buyers and the auctioneer, they would walk down the aisle. And while that is happening, the auctioneer would be leading the line with a kind of a chant, a song-like kind of a chant that gives information about pricing. And the whole thing is very, sort of like a very slow dance that is accompanied by a drone-like kind of song. And I use this recording in a sound walk and the whole work was titled, "When I Have Fears That I May Cease to Be, What Would You Give in Exchange for Your Soul?"
This is a tobacco warehouse in Rural Hall, North Carolina. The auctioneer's soul that fills the space is an ostinato of rising and falling numbers. Large bundles of death wishes extend into the horizon. Locke disappeared into cubes of tobacco that formed labyrinth rows.
And we interviewed Chuck Jordan after we made this recording about fears, because that the whole work is sort of about people's fears. And he was talking about, I guess ironically, in sort of a tobacco warehouse, he was thinking about death, and he was thinking about how when he was younger, he could walk all those aisles going up and down, really think about running out of breath. But at his age now, he's constantly looking at where he is, and it's very exhausting doing what he does. So he's aware of the fact that now he's looking to see where the song or when the song could end.
What my greatest fear about being a tobacco auctioneer is, in my younger day, I never looked for the stop sign where we were finished, because I didn't care, because I could sell all day and half the night if I had to. But now as I've gotten older, I'm 73, when I walk in the warehouse in the morning, I kind of glance back to see where the stop sign is. But I don't want anybody to see me doing that, but I do it consciously and wanting to see that stop sign, and I'm glad when I get to the stop sign now. Where I used to, it didn't bother me one bit. But I guess getting old is one of my greatest fears, that I can't do this any longer.
Young told me that he spends a third of his time researching, a third of his time making sounds, and a third of his time making sound drawings. These drawings play on the shape of sounds as he interprets them, and on synesthesia, which is the idea that sounds trigger visuals and colors. For him, B minor is a dirty purplish kind of color, and D major is brown. Sometimes he'll actually take a rubbing of an instrument, as he did for a drawing of a bell, which he made while on a journey around the world in search of bells.
I recorded this in Vienna on Austrian National Day. The lowest bell you're hearing in the recording is the Pomeran bell, which is a really large bell, but it's also rather special because it really only rings a couple of times a year. Because it's a rather large bell, but it's also quite fragile. So they try not to ring it so often. And so this recording was made as a part of like a research trip, really, like a research field trip where I went to a whole bunch of different places and recorded bell sounds. The trip was the result of a BMW prize. They don't give you like a bunch of money or anything, but they fund a 60 days trip. The proposal that I submitted was that I wanted to record bells that they have some relationship to the history of conflicts. So, and these could be actual military conflict or ideological ones. So the Pomeran is kind of the obvious one to choose. And it was cast out of cannon that was left from the Turkish siege of Vienna, and then the bell was melted down. You know, when the bell tower caught on fire and the whole thing melted down, then they built a new one, and then they pulled some old cannon out of the military museum in Austria and cast a new one with the sort of the molten remains of the old Pomeran. So the one that we're hearing now is the new Pomeran, but it has some original, let's say, ingredient material from the old Pomeran from way back. in the French countryside, one of the bells that I was looking for was this bell that was said to have magical power to cast away thunderstorm. And so you hear that a lot, actually, that people write about the magical power of bells to cast away thunderstorm. You see that sort of in records here and there. It's not uncommon. But this one bell that I was looking for is special in that the testament of its magical power was actually inscribed on the bell's surface itself. Apart from that, there also a record of local histories of laws that's been passed to explicitly prohibit the tolling of bells during a thunderstorm, because it was such a popular thing, but it was obviously a very dangerous thing to do, because when there's a thunderstorm, the bell tower really is the last thing you want to be inside of. I still haven't really figured out whether I, you know, have any desire to turn all of these recordings into a show. But I did write an orchestral piece in 2018 for the Hong Kong Sinfonietta, where I used a whole bunch of these bells.
Before the invention of modern machinery, only bells and heavy artilleries were capable of producing noises that could compete with the thunderous roars of nature. The feats of bells and cannons are intertwined. In times of war, bells would be confiscated and melted down to create cannons and rifles. When the war was over, bells were then recast out of surplus cannons and weapons. Bells also defined sonic landscapes. The auditory coverage of bells marked territories separating one community from another along cultural, religious, or ideological fault lines. There are different ways of looking at a landscape. One could focus on its beauty. One could also see the terrors of the forces of nature.
Much of Young's sound work is politically engaged. For a performance at Art Basel, he fired a sound cannon, normally used by the police for crowd control. He fired it more than 150 meters away, so that bird distress calls seem to have emerged without any clear source. In general, he pays close attention to the political climate of Hong Kong and orients much of his work locally. He runs a nonprofit called Contemporary Music King Hong Kong, which is a small sound art collective that highlights the local community. When Young and I spoke in December, the protests in Hong Kong had been going on for many months, and he sent me a field recording that captured that period in time, made by the musician Alex Yu.
So Alex Yu, he is a very interesting young composer and artist working in Hong Kong. He now works as a DJ and radio host at the Hong Kong Community Radio Station. The reason why I have this clip was because the Sound Art nonprofit organization that I help run in Hong Kong, we put out an open call for a Hong Kong mixtape a couple of months ago. We've done this for a second year now. The idea is to put together recordings that are made by artists in Hong Kong within the last year. And then we get in touch with radio station and podcasters we know and try to get that out with a narrative and to sort of talk about, you know, what happened this past year, why are these recordings made, how are they significant to the work of the artists. And his contribution it's this field recording, which is rather special because it usually composed like through composed music. It does a lot of electronic dance music. It was not something that we expected from him. But it's a recording of something that is very significant in the soundscape of protests in the last couple of months in Hong Kong. At the peak of the movement, at around 10 o'clock every night, in almost every neighborhood, you would hear people chanting the movement's slogan at the top of their volume out of their window at home. So at 10 o'clock, you would get one person who starts with the first line of the slogan, and then you would get a whole bunch of people, like a sea, like a chorus of responses from elsewhere in the district that would be saying the second line of the slogan.
What was the slogan that was being chanted?
It's Guang Fuk Hong Kong Si Dao Ga Ming. So it's revolution. Guang Fuk Hong Kong is to retake Hong Kong and revolution of our time. So it's those are the two parts of the slogan. And then sometimes that would be followed by the actual demand, which would be Mdai Soko Kut Yabat Ho. So Mdai Soko is the five demands, and Kut Yabat Ho is not one less. And so you would get somebody again chanting Mdai Soko, and then a whole bunch of people responding Kut Yabat Ho. And that's and then this just loops for a while. And that would go on, and as the movement picked up steam and as the slogan evolved, these chanting would also evolve. You don't really hear that so much now, not since the district council election. Now we are going into a phase where people are less angry, maybe. But when in the 2 months when we saw the most police brutality, this was happening literally every night. And you like actually kind of like the bell. You wouldn't need to look at the watch. You know it's 10 o'clock when that starts. It's really pretty amazing.
Playing us out there is a track called Ageya, which Young wrote for viola and electronics. Thank you for listening to the first episode of Subject Object Verb. If all goes according to plan, we hope to be releasing our show as often as we release print issues. If you have any questions or comments or lewd remarks to make, please send them to subjectobjectverb@artreview.com. Finally, as promised, Susan Cianciola will come back here with her lovely hushed voice. This is the first installment of a column titled 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds. It's named after the famous piece by John Cage, in which he instructs any performer of any instrument to not play their instrument for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. What happens is the incidental sounds of the audience and the street noise, coughing, and the environment become the piece itself. So I asked Cianciola to perform her own 4 minutes and 33 seconds, filling the space in whatever way she saw fit.
There is nothing to say that has not been said before. We only come as a reminder to tell you what you hear is what you have heard over and over again, in many different ways and in many different places.